When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Good morning, Atlanta. Welcome back to the Elise Glink Show on WSB. It is 2015. I can't believe it. We are starting another year together. I am so excited to set the table for this year. There have been so much has gone on this week. It's kind of crazy. We saw all kinds of news come back in. Interest rates ended the year near their all-time low levels. Crazy. We're going to talk about all of that, what it means to you, and what you can do this year to buy or sell more effectively, manage your money better, be smarter about identity theft, which is just off the charts insane, and all in all, hopefully live a happier, more successful, financially secure life. That's the goal for this year. 404-872-0750. I am opening up the lines right now, 1-800-WSB-TALK. You can follow me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. You can check out what's going on in the thinklinkstore.com. All kinds of great stuff happening this year, and glad you guys are along for the ride. So let's start with the numbers. I always like to start with numbers in a new year, and the biggest number that I could find is 5%, and that is the real gross domestic product, the GDP. This week was announced, or I guess it was announced a week and a half ago, just before Christmas, that it increased at an annual rate of 5% in the third quarter of 2014, according to the third or final estimate. Corporate profits grew $64.5 billion, 5%. That, for my money, is directly tied to lower gas prices. And where are gas prices? Wow, I drove by. Now, Chicago has one of the more expensive gas markets in the country. Atlanta is one of the cheaper ones. I have seen gas prices online for different places in the country range from $1.87 a gallon to about $2.25 a gallon, where I just paid at Costco, I think $2.22 the other day. Absolutely insane. It wasn't that long ago, like at the beginning of the year, when gas prices were closing in or above $4 a gallon. The difference between $4 a gallon and $2 a gallon, roughly speaking, $2 a gallon, is huge. When you fill up a tank, you're talking about $35 a fill. And if you're filling up twice a week, that's $70 a week. You are talking some serious coin for the end of the year in your pocket. And that, for my money, is fueling what's going on with the GDP. 5% growth is unbelievable. It's off the charts. It's a little, maybe even be unsustainable. And we'll see what happens in the fourth quarter. But that number was pretty interesting. Another number that was interesting was the personal income number that also came in just before Christmas. Personal income in November increased nearly 0.5%. Nominal personal consumption expenditures, the PCE, right? So what are we spending every day at the grocery store and other things, rose a little better than 0.5%. We are seeing real progress for personal income. It's not enough yet. Yet we're not making a tremendous amount of moves from where we've been. But in general, the fact that we're moving up is big. And what happened January 1st, across the country in many states, we saw the minimum wage jump. So in a lot of places, we're now seeing people get a serious increase in the minimum wage. It affects so many people, working families who are doing the kind of jobs that they can do, and now they're getting a big pay raise. That is going to profoundly also, I think, affect what is going on. People are going to have more money in their pocket. They're going to be able to afford more things, and that's terrific. So where did the news fall down? This is kind of interesting, right? We've got mortgage interest rates near 2014 lows. We've got sales of new single-family homes, new construction, which is a big driver, typically, of the economy. Sales of new single-family homes in November were at 438,000. That's the seasonally adjusted annual rate, down 1.6% from October's revised rate, and it was down 1.6% from November of 2013. So new single-family home sales not doing so great. 438,000 is less than half of where it should be. We're still in a depression as far as new construction is going, and we're also seeing existing home sales fall. Not fall a lot, but they're faltering. They're definitely not increasing, and that's with more product coming on the market. More people are saying, hey, it's the new year. It's the beginning of the spring season. Right, by the way, it is January 2nd is the official beginning of the spring selling season, although it doesn't really kick into gear until March and April. So what we're seeing is a really interesting bag, right? We've got a little bit more income in our pockets. We're definitely spending less at the pump. And for vast majority of people, spending less at the pump is a huge boon for them. It's a huge savings because that's after-tax money. Even if you're in the lowest tax bracket, you get a bump from that. So if we gas prices stay low, and they're expected to stay low through much of this year, we've got interest rates that are low, and the Fed is telling us that they're going to keep interest rates low for a while. Janet Yellen doesn't see any reason to move those. But on the other hand, so that's good news, right? But on the other hand, you've got construction, new construction not so great, not only because people aren't buying those homes, but because people aren't building those homes. It's really the building jobs. And now we've got the Keystone Pipeline construction stuff coming up for a vote. We've got new Congress coming in. And I was watching the news this morning, and Chuck Schumer was saying that he's going to add a whole bunch of amendments and say that the steel that they use for the pipeline has to be made in America, and we need more jobs attached to it. And, you know, the fight continues, right? We're back to where we started. And yet, it seems to me that we've made a little bit of progress, a little more progress this year, right? Overall, last month, we had added over 300,000 jobs. That is like, I don't know, the 19th or 25th month in a row that we've added jobs. We're now at a number that is above where we were for jobs. The total number of jobs is above where it was in 2008, just as we were heading into the downturn. And I think back to where we were as we started 2008, from 2007 at the very end, you know, November. I remember a guy who owned a Lexus dealership calling me and telling me he had his best month ever in October of 2007. And I said, yeah, well, that's good for you. Not so good for everybody else. And everything started to crash. And then look where we were in 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011. I can't believe how many years have gone by. How many years have gone by until we get to this place here where we're still not fully healed. The stock market, unbelievable, right? It went down about 220 points this week, but we were over 18,000. Remember at the low, we were at 6,600. We have tripled. The stock market has tripled in that short a period of time. Since 2008, 2009, I believe we hit the low on March 9th, my husband Sam's birthday. And now, you know, since March 9th of 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and now we're into 15. So 4.5 years later, we've tripled the stock market. That is a lot of money that has been rebuilt for many Americans, wealthy and middle class as well. So there's been a lot of comeback, and I feel very encouraged as we start this year that we have a lot of things going in the right direction. And hopefully the game is that we will continue to move in the right direction so that everybody feels that their paycheck is going into something really, you know, solid, really solid. And I want that to be the case for you. So what are we going to work on this year? For me personally, I'm doing what I always do. I'm a little like Clark that way. You know, you want to always be very careful with your spending. I'm not saying don't spend. I'm just saying, it's really nice if you can pay cash for it, or if you're going to charge it because you want to get the Affinity credit card benefits, you want to be able to pay off that credit card at the end of the month. This is not a year to accumulate debt other than deductible debt or school debt. And school debt, I want you to be super careful. You know, talk to your kids who are juniors. My younger son, Michael, is a junior this year, and we're already having the conversation about school and costs and what he's going to do and how much we're going to pay, how much he should pay. I feel very strongly that our kids should help out and get jobs in the summer, make some money, spend that money. So when they want to do the extras, that doesn't come out of my pocket. That's coming out of their pocket. They have to learn that as well. So what are you going to spend your money on this year? What are the priorities for the year? You know, for us, college tuition and saving for college tuition have got at the top of the list. But what about you? When you look out across the next year or two, do you have a car that needs purchasing? Are you going to try and buy a house? Are you thinking about making some sort of big investment? Do you want to have a lifestyle change? Are you selling your house, downsizing? Are you retiring? What is the big ticket item for you this year? And how are you going to get there? Let's map out a strategy that makes sense from the day that you start planning for it all the way through to date of completion, and then you get to enjoy it. So that's what I'm thinking about this year. Would love to hear what you're thinking about. 404-872-0750. Happy to answer your questions online. You can also go to thinklink.com or Twitter at Glink. And then something new that we've been doing the last couple of months, I don't know if you've checked it out. On the Elise Glink Facebook page, you can be a fan of the Facebook page for sure, like 6,000 or 7,000 other people. But what we're doing is we post our column questions and answers there every single day. There are so many interesting things that people are facing. You will undoubtedly enjoy seeing some of the commentary that's going back and forth about how some of the people who correspond with me are dealing with their lives. I'm sure you'll find that entertaining as well. Check it out at facebook.com/Elise Glink. All right, 18 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750. WSB.
It's 11:25 on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We've got a prize pack we'll give away next hour, so stay tuned for that. Lines are empty, folks. Is anybody awake yet? Maybe not. Maybe everybody's still sleeping off New Year's Eve. I don't know. I will talk for a moment about what the best ways are to pay down debt. So I know that coming off of Christmas, there are a whole lot of listeners who are either dreading their credit card bills or who are already receiving them and absolutely wondering how they're going to manage that. It is so common to get into debt around the holidays. I can't even tell you, for all these years that I've been writing about money, thinking about money, I know that the Christmas hangover for most people happens in January and February. It also, you know, is the time that we take stock of our finances and we make our resolutions. And I talked a couple of weeks ago about New Year's resolutions and what you should think about as you're going forward with them. But when you're faced with, you know, the black and white of a credit card bill and you know you don't have enough money in your account, wow, there's nothing worse there. So what do you do about paying down debt? Because it actually is going to take some work. It takes some smart money management, but I'm not saying it's complicated, right? It's about creating a plan and sticking to it. Think of it as a money diet, much the same way that you're giving up carbs. Well, actually, I'm giving up carbs, or most carbs, for the new year. You know it's important. You know you have to do it. You know you've got 5 pounds to lose from, you know, all the Christmas cookies you've been eating. And yet, it takes work and discipline. But really, the hardest part is when you just get started, because you don't necessarily need to pay all of your debt immediately. You can focus on spending less and putting every available cent towards getting that debt paid down to a more manageable level. And I've got 5 steps that will help you work on it. So number one, make a list of all your debt, right? If you make a list of all of it, including credit cards, student loans, whatever, mortgage, and then next to the debt, the amount of it, you're going to want to have your credit card, whatever the interest rate is on it. And once you get the interest rate down, then you're going to want to think about, is there a better way that you could manage that debt? But once you've got to really start by making a list of it. If you can't remember all of your debt, then you really have a problem. But you can also go to annualcreditreport.com and get a free credit report, and that should list any debt that's attributed to you. excuse me. Number two is you got to prioritize the payments. Now, there are two ways to do this that I think work really well. One is you make a list of the lowest to highest amounts that you owe. And you pay off the lowest amount first, and because it helps you free up extra money on that minimum payment to throw at the next lowest amount and next lowest amount. The other way to do it is to take the highest interest rate debt and throw everything at that because that's the biggest savings. So you've got to prioritize your payments. Just pick one. If you've got a super high interest rate, you may want to ask for a lower interest rate, especially if you've exhibited good credit behavior, so the lender may be willing to negotiate. Fourth is to monitor your spending, right? I mean, there are a lot of people who don't make $150,000 a year who are able to get their debts paid off. It's really about spending less than you earn. So track the spending and figure out what you can give up. You're going to have to make some trade-offs, at least in the beginning. This is a good way to do it. And the fifth is to put extra cash towards your debt, which I've been saying all along, but even the $20 birthday check is worth putting towards your debt if it means you're going to get out of debt 2 months faster. Five really important steps. You can read them at blog.equifax.com, where I'm the managing editor, and I'm going to tweet that out in just a few minutes. When we come back, we're going to take your calls. Lines are still open, 404-872-0750 on the Elyse Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elyse Glink is live, here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on News 95.5 and AM 750. WSB.
It's 11:36 on the Elyse Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time in 2015 here on WSB. Thanks for making us the number one radio station last year, and I hope that continues too. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We've got some lines open, but I have a question that somebody tweeted me. Zen Lee sent a note, and he said, we just bought a house in Montana near Yellowstone and want to rent it out seasonally. Any advice for first-time vacation rental owners? We live in Georgia, by the way, and we've hired a cleaning company out by the vacation home, and we don't know exactly how to manage it. So that's a great question, because I think a lot of people this year have thought about buying a house in order to rent it out. And we've had all kinds of investors really supporting the marketplace, right? They've done a tremendous amount to actually sop up the rentals that or the properties that nobody else wanted. So if you're a first-time vacation rental owner, which is, you know, now you've got the property, you've already bought it, now what are you going to do with it? So I think that there are some good things. One is VRBO. VRBO is vacationrentalbyowner.com. It's a great website. It's been around for a while. When Sam and I are going on vacation and we want to rent a place, that's where we go. And so do all of our friends. In fact, we have some of our really close friends just were down in the Caribbean for Christmas, and they rented the most amazing property with an incredible view of the water. It's incredible. They had a pool, and then over that they see, you know, the waters and the Caribbean. It's really, really beautiful. And so there are great deals to be had, and you have to learn how to sort through the good and the bad. But learning how to write a really great description of your property, what's so wonderful about it, is going to help you on VRBO, and it's a way to connect. You also could look at Airbnb, which is another place that you can list your property and rent out different rooms for it. So I would say to you that figuring out how you're going to get things, get the word out about it is important. You may want to set up your own website. There's a new, not so new, but there's a really cool technology called Square Pages, which I think is probably going to take over the market for kind of low-cost websites. Very, very easy to use. Really designed for beautiful, beautiful photos. And so what you'll want to do is go and take all these wonderful photos of Yellowstone and photos of the house and the view from the house, if there is one, and make sure you get it all organized on this website. And the website should probably be named, you know, fabulousvacationrentalnearyellowstone.com. You know, something that people are really searching for, so it rises in the ranks. And in fact, I should talk more this year about search. I did a little bit of this at the end of last year, one of the shows. You know, my company, my content marketing company, ThinkLink Media, we do a lot of search and SEO work and content work for companies. And So we're very well versed in how to get people to notice you online. And so this is one of the things that I would do if I had a vacation rental. The name, the URL, the name that you actually name it, should be descriptive of how somebody's going to search for that. So I would type in, if I were looking for something at Yellowstone, fabulous vacation rental near Yellowstone. And if your website is called fabulousvacationrentalnearyellowstone.com, that's going to pop up higher in the search engine. So you want to think about all of that in order to make it work. And then you're going to want to take a significant enough deposit so that if something goes wrong, you're going to be able to work with it. And then I think you really need to make sure that the people pay up front, that certain amount is non-refundable. And so you're going to have to work through the rules of the rentals. If you go on VRBO.com, I think you'll get a sense of what everybody else is doing in your neighborhood. And that's going to be pretty important because you're going to want to be charging about what everybody else is charging, unless yours is really fabulous. And you're going to want to make sure your rules are about the same because people who shop on VRBO for a place are conditioned to finding certain things. So you want to meet the middle and move forward from there. If you've got other questions, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, and you can also tweet me online, at Glink. All right, let's go to the phones. Jimmy joins us on the line now. Hey, Jimmy, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Hi there.
Hi there. Happy 2015.
Happy 2015 to you also.
Thank you.
I got a question. Can one person of a spouse, husband and wife, I have a lot of credit card debt. She doesn't. Mm-hmm. Can I file for personal bankruptcy and it not affect her?
Yes. It shouldn't. If you file for personal bankruptcy and she is not named on any of the debts, that should just affect your credit history and not hers.
Okay.
However, if you go to buy a property.
All right. Thank you very much.
That was it? That's the whole question right there? Okay, well, I guess it is. Well, for everybody else listening, other than Jimmy, who's now offline, the thing about that, there's a few nuances, right? There's nothing on the show that's ever so cut and dried, but there are some nuances you want to be aware of. One is that somebody may have be tied in via Social Security number, so maybe both of you applied for a credit card, not just her. That would be an issue then if you filed for bankruptcy. She assumes all of the debt, and so she'll still have to pay it. Another issue is if you go to buy something, right? You buy a house, you refinance your mortgage. If you own a house together and there's a mortgage on it and you're both named on that mortgage, that can be a problem for her. But if you're going to go buy a new car and you need and her income isn't enough to qualify and she needs your income, that's going to be a problem because you're coming out of bankruptcy, so your credit history is going to be trashed. So there's some things to think through, but if you have all of your own debt and all of your own credit and the two of you have not intertwined anything, then she should probably be okay. But you're going to want to talk to your bankruptcy attorney about it, and you're going to need bankruptcy education as well, and she may need to go to those classes just to learn some of the things that she's going to be working on. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Robin joins me on the line from Decatur. Hi, Robin.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's going on this year for you?
Well, I own three properties, and I already have an LLC, but I don't know how to take the properties from my name and put them under the LLC.
Why do you have an LLC?
Just because I wanted them, because I own the properties, and I wanted to take the names out of my name and put them under the company's name.
Okay. Do they have mortgages?
Yes. Two of them do.
So taking them out of your name and putting them into the name of the LLC will likely or could violate your mortgage agreement. Are you aware of that?
Well, they actually have. No, I didn't. And there's only one that has a mortgage on it.
Okay.
Two of them don't, one of them does.
Okay. So if the mortgage company comes knocking at your door or they somehow receive a notification that you are no longer the owner of the properties, they could rescind your mortgage overnight.
Okay.
Just be aware of that.
Okay.
The way that you move properties around is you move them, you can do it with a quit claim deed, or you can have an attorney do it, and you basically transfer ownership of the property or all of the interests that you have in those properties to the name of the LLC. But I, because you have three properties and one of them has a mortgage, I would rather you not do a quick claim deed on your own, downloading it from the internet or from NOLO.com and just sort of signing it over. And you also need to file it with the recorder's office of deeds. So it's not just signing the piece of paper. It's also now you're going to go and record that and put the world on notice that you have shifted the ownership of those properties.
What I'm trying to do is, in owning property, I'm trying to take just my name so that as I'm leasing it, it's just not my personal name. And also, obviously, trying to protect my own personal investments and property. Is there a way to do that?
Well, so taking your name off the ownership because you don't want anybody seeing it, is that what you want to do?
Yes.
Okay, but when people go to rent the property, they're going to call you or they're calling a management company?
Well, don't have a management company yet, so I guess they still will call me. But I was thinking they would call me under the property's name somehow.
But they're going to go, hi, this is 123 Bleecker Street? And you're going to go, okay. No, it's Robin. I'm the owner. And then what was the point of that transfer?
Okay.
But I wanted
to kind of distance myself so that, you know, they don't have all my personal information as well.
But
that's what I was trying to do.
But, okay, so, Robin, the truth of the matter is anybody in 8 seconds can find out all that information. And even when you transfer it over, there are still ways to pierce it. So what you're trying to do is really protect yourself from the additional possible liability.
Right.
So you can do umbrella liability. You can still transfer this into an LLC. But I always get worried when people, who created the LLC for you?
I did it through, and I can't think of it, there's an internet company.
An internet company. Okay, so you had no legal advice on this?
No.
Okay. Are you a lawyer?
No.
Okay. So I'm, as the daughter of a lawyer, sister of a lawyer, cousins to lawyers, niece of a lawyer, and wife to a lawyer, I'm always worried about people who play lawyers when they're not, except when they're on TV. Because there are so many ramifications that go into making this kind of legal change. It seems like it's all easy, and you hear these commercials, oh, start up your LLC, and life will be wonderful, and you're going to have the sunshine on your face. And, you know, it's just not quite how it works. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to find a really good real estate attorney. And when you have three rental properties plus your own personal property, assume you own that as well, you've got four properties, and that's a significant amount of assets. And it's worth a conversation with a real estate attorney about what you're doing and why you want to do it. And to get some professional legal advice from somebody who really understands real estate law in the state of Georgia, I assume you're in the state of Georgia, or you're in Decatur,
yeah,
right? So that you are making a smart move based in knowledge, right? So that you understand fully what liability you are relieving and what you're engendering and what you're going to have to do and what it's going to cost you to file tax returns if you need to do that and how it's actually going to work for you. I also want you to have a conversation with your tax preparer. Do you do your own taxes?
Yes.
Okay. So transferring it into an LLC may have an impact on your taxes, positively or negatively. So if you bought the new TurboTax, do you use TurboTax?
Yes.
This year, by the way, you have to buy the new home and business. You can't just do the home anymore.
Yeah, I have that one.
Yeah, it's annoying. We had a return. Sam was really annoyed because he knows how to do the Schedule C, and he doesn't need to upgrade for $40 to do the Schedule C, and they wouldn't let him just do the Schedule C, so now he had to spend $40, but whatever. Anyway, I want you to talk to the lawyer first, decide what you're going to do, and before you actually go ahead and do it, I want you to start running things through your TurboTax so that you understand fully all of the impact. And then once you transfer all these into the LLC, you may have to change the insurance coverage you have. And in any case, I would recommend an umbrella liability policy.
Okay.
All right?
One other quick question. Can you give me a reference or where I should look for a good real estate attorney?
Yes, I can. You can call the Decatur Bar Association, if they have one, if not the Atlanta Bar Association, the Georgia Bar Association, and ask them to refer you to the head of the real estate committee. Once you talk to the head of the real estate committee, explain what you're looking for, ask for three recommendations, and go from there, because the people who hang out at the real estate committee are the ones who are most committed to staying on top of new laws and regulations and what's going on, and they tend to be very, very involved and connected. It's a wonderful place to go. Happy New Year, Robin. Let me know what happens. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Elise Glink, Sundays on News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours.
I'm having a very lively conversation about ways to pay down your debt on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter, at Glink. And if you search Twitter, go up to that search box and just type in at Glink. The conversation should pop up with Practical Tracy about what to do with your credit card debt. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Ann joins me on the line, also from Decatur. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Elise. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. My question is this. I'm 64 years old. I have a house that I have about $275,000 worth of equity in, but I still have a mortgage payment of $1,000 a month.
How long do you have left on the mortgage?
About 10 years.
Okay.
And I want to completely retire. I'm working part-time now, and I have a part-time income of about $46,000.
Okay.
I'm thinking about a reverse mortgage, but the fees and costs on it seem extremely high.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I worry that I'm really too young to get it, that the income from it might not last long enough. And so I'm thinking, well, should I get a reverse mortgage or just sell my house and buy a smaller place, a condo maybe, for cash and not have any mortgage payment at all?
So I think one of the things you have to think about is how long you would stay in this house. At 64, you'd have to tell me that you're going to stay for 30 years the rest of your life for me to even consider that a reverse mortgage would be worth it. And I got to tell you, if you've got stairs, I don't know when you're 85 if you want to do stairs for 10 years after that.
No, it's a totally stepless house, which is great. And I could envision staying here for, 20 years at least.
Okay.
But I love the house. I love where it is. I'm just trying to figure out the payment dilemma. I don't want to be still paying on a mortgage when I'm 74 years old.
I think that your easy answer is going to be to sell it and take your equity and buy something for cash. And the reason I say that is that if you go in with a reverse mortgage and you've got a house that clearly is worth, how much is the house worth, by the way?
Probably between 425 and 450.
Okay, so you've got a significant amount of mortgage left? You've got $200,000 left of the mortgage?
No, about $140,000.
$140,000.
Yeah.
Okay, so then that would bring your house to like $415,000. So maybe
right.
You have more equity. Maybe you've got $300,000 of equity. Regardless, it's a...
It just, depends on what the market is at the time.
Sure. So I would say to you that that's a nice amount to be able to take and buy something that you can live in cash. If you get a reverse mortgage, here's what's going to happen. Your mortgage payment could disappear entirely, which would be great. And now you're just going to have taxes, insurance on a $450,000 house. Those are going to continue to go up, and you're going to have to pay for those going forward.
Right.
And you're going to have maintenance and upkeep on the house. So,
true. But I would also have maintenance and upkeep on whatever I bought.
Well,
property.
The difference between a single family house, maintenance and upkeep, or a condo, for example, those are two different things. But even if you buy a smaller single family house, it's just going to be less money. It's less money in taxes. It's less money to heat. It's less money to insure. It's less money to fix up. It's less money.
Yeah.
So getting a smaller property for, let's say, $250,000 might make a whole lot of sense to you if you can stay in your neighborhood and you buy something that, is good, especially if you've got ample other assets to worry about. Now, what are you going to have for income going forward?
Well, my part-time income is around $30,000, and I was including I get about $16,000 a year on Social Security. I'm taking early Social Security, so I have that, but really very little else. I don't have much in the way of a pension or IRA.
So you're going to live on $16,000 of Social Security going forward?
That and whatever excess equity I have in my house after I buy something else.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you, Ann, I think that the reverse mortgage is out because I don't think you're going to be able to afford your house. And I think that's going to be a real problem for you going forward. I think you should maybe think about renting. I think you could probably rent something for hopefully less than $16,000 a year with Social Security. But if you have a house that you're living in, you're going to have that you're going to really have other expenses that might cost you at least $8,000 a year. That's going to leave you nothing to live on. So I'm a little concerned. If you rent, at least you've got the rest of your money there. And I really think you've got to rethink this retiring, because if you've got part-time income of $46,000 a year, if you can use that for the next 5 or 7 years and build up, I think you're going to have your house will be worth more. You're going to have much more stability going forward. I really think you have to rethink the retiring early. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink. Come back soon. We'll be back in a moment with more on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, answering your money and real estate questions. Rebuilding America, one house at a time. Starting with yours, News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Welcome back, everybody. It's 12:07 on the Elise Glink Show, 2015, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB. We've got some lines open. 404-872-0750 is our number here at the station. Happy to answer your questions. 1-800-WSB-TALK. If you haven't checked out my YouTube channel, we have a whole bunch of new videos up there. It is Expert Real Estate Tips. That's the name of it. Or you can just type in my name to YouTube. It'll pop up. So we've been talking a little bit about the economic fundamentals and what's going on, and it's worth talking about what the housing outlook looks like. And I got one from CoreLogic, which is a big data aggregator, really interesting data aggregator, especially for the housing industry. And CoreLogic sees the post-crisis expansion, economic expansion, coming through its fifth birthday and sees steady improvement in consumption, how much we're spending, and capital improvements. Employment grew at an average of 2% year over year for the 3 months ending in November. That was the strongest rate since March of 2006, which was peak employment growth for the last economic expansion. So that's pretty good. What they see as being most interesting is that employment for millennials, right, these are people in their late teens and early 20s, has begun to improve dramatically. And it's really the 25 to 29-year-old segment that experienced a 3% growth in employment that was faster than overall employment growth. And here's what's important about that. This is a crucial time for millennials. When you are 25 to 29 years old, you're thinking about a few things. Number one, how am I going to continue to improve my career? Number two, am I going to get married, settle down, long-term relationship? Am I going to have kids? Number three, where am I going to live with my growing family? And so these are really crucial components of a successful housing industry. What we have seen in the housing industry over the last couple of years is that this age group, which has grown, right? You know, they haven't always been 20 to 25 to 29. The kids who are 25 to kids, listen to me. The 25 to 29 year olds today at the beginning of the crisis were 19 to 24, right? So they've aged 5 years as well. And they were the ones who were getting out of college. And they're the ones who got really hard hit. The ones who are even in worse shape are the ones who are, like, say, 29 to 35, because they were just coming out of college when all of this happened. And they're the ones who may, I think, have a really tough time, you know, throughout the rest of their career, simply because these first few years are so rough. But in any case, the 25 to 29-year-olds are a key part of the first-time homebuyer segment. The average age of homeownership, of first-time homeownership in this country, is now about 32. And there's talk that that's going to go up to 34 because houses are more expensive and people aren't making as much in their jobs and they have to save more because it's a little bit more stringent, the rules around mortgages, right? And so very important to the first-time buyer market is this group of millennials, and they are key. And they're also showing more mobility. They're showing higher marginal tendencies to consume from the income. So making more money, we talked about that last hour, people are making a little bit more money now, and they have less costs, right? Gas prices at the pump down significantly. All of that ties to how much people are going to be able to spend. And by the way, it also reduces the expenses of homeownership because energy bills are a really big part of homeownership, and those costs are going down as well. So CoreLogic sees a lot of this improving dramatically, excuse me, and especially with modest interest rates, we don't see the Fed moving that quickly to change the interest rate picture. So even though home prices have gone up tremendously, we saw mortgage interest rates in December dip below 3.9% for the first time since May of 2013. And so interest rates are going down. Home prices are not going down, but, you know, rents are high. So, you know, home buying is really the path forward. And millennials are going to figure that out. So stronger economic fundamentals this year mean that the demand for housing should increase. Right? When you've got a strong economy and you've got jobs, that translates into strong real estate. If you've got a job and you know you're not going to get fired, you are much more inclined to think about making a long-term investment. That's what a house is. A house is not like buying a share of stock, right? You can trade a share of stock multiple times in a day. You can make money, you can lose money. You can't do that with a house. You just can't. And so we're seeing housing starts continue to increase for new construction. The sales aren't there yet, but they will. And we've seen mortgage interest rates rise. Okay, well, they've gone down, and they're not expected to rise much beyond 4.3%. Last year at this time, we were saying interest rates were going to be over 5% by the end of 2014. Nowhere near that. We're under 4%. So they think they're going to increase a little bit. And now we're going to just see, they're going to try and loosen the requirements for credit and see what that changes things. So you could easily see, as the economy continues to pick up steam and strong employment growth continues, first-time home buyers are going to take that step, and they're going to make a move, and they're going to buy a house. And so CoreLogic is predicting, their economists are predicting, that home sales will increase about 9% in 2015, housing starts will grow 14%, and home price growth will moderate. And we'll see if they're right. I hope they are. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Chris joins me on the line from Sandy Springs. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking
my
call.
Happy
I have a home I want to sell at about $1.5 million. I'm trying to choose a real estate agent whose company has brought the buyers. That is, people who are qualified buyers and out shopping through that company's agents, their buyer's agents.
Uh-huh.
How do I choose that real estate company to list with then?
Well, you're making some assumptions that I'm not quite certain of. Why is it that you want to have a buyer's agent, or you're going to sell on your own?
I want to list my home and have them sell it for me, but just having a good firm that's got a big name for listings is one thing. I'm hoping that that same firm will have a lot of buyers who have bought homes in my price bracket in my community, Sandy Springs. How can I identify that real estate agent?
Well, you can talk to managing brokers of various offices about what they do to get out the word. One of the things, the reason this might be important is over the last 3 or 4 months, we're seeing something that I actually haven't seen in real estate in about 20 years. And that is the rise of the pocket listing. Now, I actually don't think a pocket listing is in your, as a seller's, best interest, but a lot of real estate companies are now not really officially listing, because there are rules around once your property is officially listed, how fast it has to get to the MLS, which is usually 24 to 48 hours. But it's called a pocket listing because what they do is they market it internally to their own brokers and their own brokers' buyers to begin with, as an informal listing. Like, it's not really a listing. We've signed it, but we haven't actually listed it yet. But if you've got a buyer, bring them over. The reason they do that is because most brokerage companies are still incentivizing people to do in-house deals. They make more money that way. So when you say you want to find a house, or excuse me, you want to find a brokerage company that has a big name for buyers as well, it makes me think that what you're trying to do is do an in-house pocket listing, because you think that there's going to be some sort of benefit to that above getting it out there and having everybody take a crack at it. But I don't know why you feel that way.
Well, I'm just hoping that there are some companies that represent corporations, say, in other cities that are transferring people to the Metro Atlanta, and who will be representing those executives who want to buy a house in Sandy Springs, for example.
Okay. So that's a very specific ask. So I think what you have to do is you have to talk to the managing brokers of companies that all do business in your area. I'm sure you're not the nicest house in your neighborhood. I'm sure you live in a neighborhood of very nice houses.
Mm-hmm.
So you must know which two or three or four companies, and maybe even which two or three, four brokers are always listing homes in your neighborhood.
Okay.
I would start there. I would call the managing broker tomorrow, and I would say, I have a very expensive home, and I'm thinking about listing it with your company, but I want to understand what your relationship is with transferring companies locally that transfer executives, because I have an executive-priced house, and I want to understand how you work with that, those kinds of companies that may be able to bring the right buyer to my door. And I would start that way. And you'll be able to find out, because they'll tell you exactly who in the office is working with those kinds of companies, who has those relationships, and at what price point they typically work. And then you'll make a decision about which of the agents for each of those four firms you want to talk to. And I would have them come to the house, do a comparative marketing analysis, see who you like, and basically have them bid for your business.
And if I have them bid for my business, what are the criteria that I can use in negotiating with them for their contract? Is it strictly real estate fee? Is it a reduced fee if the same listing agent also brings the buyer?
Well, I don't think you want to cut back on what the listing, what the buyer's agent gets, simply because I think that even though brokers will tell you that they aren't going to pass by your house for a lower commission, I think sometimes they do. So what I would do is say to them, listen, you know, this is a partnership. I want to understand what your best offer is going to be. And there are a lot of different ways that companies structure this. So for a higher priced home, you might pay 5% for the first million and 4% thereafter. You might pay 3% or 3.5% for the first million if it's an in-house deal, and then 5% thereafter. So you have to understand what's going on in your neighborhood and what people are doing. And that's why you want to talk to three or four different brokerage companies that all work in your neighborhood. Because, you know, with a higher priced house, you typically have to put in more work. And I've seen this because my mother's been a, you know, high-end real estate agent in Chicago for many, many years. And so sometimes with these very expensive houses, they can sit for a while until the right person comes along. Sometimes it's like nothing, and then you think, oh, I should have paid less for that work. But it's a crapshoot, right? Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But you can certainly, if you ask each of them, and you let them know you're talking to the top three or four agents for the neighborhood, and you want to know what their best fee structure is and what they would propose, I think you'll find that people will be willing to work with you.
Very good. Well, thank you for your help today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling the show. 19 minutes past the hour. When we come back, we're going to do our prize pack on the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America in 2015, one house at a time, starting with yours. So we have our prize pack to give away. Value's $132. It includes a family four-pack of tickets to see the Gwinnett Gladiators versus the South Carolina Stingrays on January 10th at the arena at Gwinnett Center, and a four-pack of tickets to the Georgia RV and Camper Show January 9th through the 11th at the North Atlanta Trade Center. Again, that value, $132. We're going to give it away to the fifth caller at 404-741-0750, 404-741-0750. Good luck. Be nice to Crystal. She's the one taking your call. 26 minutes past the hour. This is, I want to reach out and just say that, you know, I always say to you, you can follow me on Twitter, and that my handle is at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. And I talk about my Facebook page, the fan page at Elise Glink. You can just go there and find me there and follow it and all the rest. But I should mention that I have a pretty active LinkedIn site as well, and we do a whole lot of work there for ThinkLink Media, which is my content marketing company, but of course, just Elise Glink as well. And so you're more than welcome to link into me there. I pretty much accept everybody, unless I'm sure you're a scam person calling from I don't know where else. But you know, you're more than welcome to link in there. But one person just sent me a question there, which is great, and I don't have time to answer it before the break, but I'm going to try to get to it today. And if not, we'll do it before it takes root. But the question that he is asking about is the changes that are coming down the pike from Fannie Mae, and there are some requirements for mortgages and the mortgage process that will be changed after January 26th of 2015. So appraisals are just at the heart of what went wrong with the mortgage process prior to the housing crisis. And there was a lot of concern about what was happening with appraisals. Well, they're still trying to fix in quotes, that issue. And there's a lot of stuff to talk about. So there have been some changes that are going to come down the pike, and I will try and get to these sometime over the next, hopefully the next half hour. But if not, we'll do it in the next week or two. 27 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We'll be back in a moment with more to take your questions on The Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.
Elise Glink, Sundays on News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours.
Welcome back, everybody. It's 12:35 on the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours here on WSB. So proud to be in WSB. 404-872-0750. That's our number here at the station, or you can dial 1-800-WSB-TALK, and we'll pay for the call. All right, 36 minutes past the hour. Let's go back to the phone. Susan joins me on the line from Atlanta. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Elise.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you. Well, what's going on?
Okay, here's my situation. I bought a home, and this was probably about the year 2000 or so, and mortgage was in my name, mm-hmm. but my mother, who had some health issues, was going to live with me. So at the closing table, I did a quit claim deed, put her name on the title. I was just thinking, in case anything happened to me, didn't want her to have to get out or whatever. Well, now, years later, she's considering going into a nursing facility. And so what I've been hearing is, I guess, you know, you have to sign over all your income to them, to the nursing home. And then if you have any property, I guess you're supposed to sell it or whatever. I just put her on just to put her on. And so now I'm concerned that my home is going to be somehow attached to her.
It is attached to her. You made a snap decision without consulting anybody. I started the show talking about how when you have legal questions, you really should, you know, legal issues should talk to a lawyer. Don't play a lawyer, except if you're on TV, because it is her house. You gave her half that house at the closing table.
Gosh.
Well, that's what you did. You could have solved that problem in so many other ways. If you had proper advice at the closing table, if you'd actually had a lawyer who was on your side as opposed to the lawyer who was just for the mortgage company that you were paying, the lawyer would have said, hey, there are some ramifications to doing this. And if you're just worried about her having to get out, which you could fix that with a will. You could fix it by putting the house into a trust. A reversible trust, so at least she was named as the beneficiary of it. Or if you had children, you know, you could pass it along to them. You could give her a life estate. There were all kinds of ways to solve that problem, except you gave her half the house. So now you're in a situation where is she going to be on Medicaid?
No.
Okay.
I think it was she has that insurance where Medicare pays her insurance holder to make all the decisions. So she's not even billed by Medicare anymore when she has health issues,
mm-hmm.
because it's the provider that takes care of everything. So,
Except that she owns this, I was told,
hey, I may want to sell in the next few years, that if I sell, and say I remove her now, that mm-hmm. they can still come after me and come back after the fact to collect. I'm just...
Yes, they can come back for up to 5, maybe even 7 years.
But that's just not right. She's not on the mortgage.
It doesn't matter. So. The mortgage is irrelevant. It matters that she owns it. It matters that she owns it, not the mortgage. In fact, you know, you put her on as an owner, but she's been an owner now for 14 years with you, and... You know, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant that she's not in the mortgage. In fact, you've probably violated your mortgage. I'm surprised that the mortgage lender's attorney, who was probably sitting at the closing, mm-hmm. didn't say to you, you're violating your mortgage agreement by doing this. But they didn't.
No. And, you know, the interesting thing is I've heard in recent years that they usually don't let you put your parents on. But I was thinking, well, they didn't say anything to me. They let me do it. They said you can go the other way and put children on. And, you know, the reason I did that is because when I was younger, my mother always, you know, she put me on her house. So I guess, you know.
Oh, but that's bad advice. Yeah. It's bad. It's just bad. It's bad. And look at all these problems it's causing you now. And even if you try to buy out her interest in the home, you would have to pay going market rate for it, right? Because if you don't pay the going market rate for it, then it looks like it's just a give back, which is what it is. If she signs a quick claim deed and gives you back the house, which mm-hmm. you get back at the price that you paid for it, that's not even the issue. They can come after you if she ever needs government assistance and saying that, you know, you if it's within that 5-year period and she needs to go on Medicaid for whatever reason, they can come back and sue you for the house. What'll end up happening is when you sold it, they would just take half the proceeds of it because that was what she actually owned. So you need professional help, Susan.
Oh. Yes,
now you have to pay for a lawyer because you need to talk to an elder care attorney and possibly an estate attorney who can help you figure out a way out of this situation where you are right now.
Okay, so let me ask you, if I didn't sell, could they force me to sell to get money?
They probably wouldn't force you to sell. What they would do is they would put a lien against the property, and when you do sell, whenever it is, they would take the money.
Oh.
Half of it. So if the property goes up another $100,000 in the next 10 years, they would take their $50,000 of that plus the other half.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it wasn't so good. Not one of your best moments, I think, unfortunately. And please, going forward, tell your kids not to do this if you have kids. But I want you to find a really good estate or elder care attorney right now, tomorrow, that can help you think through where you are and what your legal options are going to be. Okay? Because I don't really know what you're... I don't know all the details, and I'm not a lawyer, and I don't try to play one on this radio show, but I do know enough as the wife of a lawyer and the daughter of a lawyer, sister of a lawyer, cousin of lawyers, niece of a lawyer, that you need a lawyer. Let me tell you how to find one, okay?
Okay.
Because
okay.
I really want you to, you know, have the best kind of assistance here, and... You could find yourself in a situation where they come after all of it, not just half. So you want to call the Atlanta Bar Association, and you want to ask for the head of the estate committee or the head of the elder care committee. Attorneys who deal every day with elder issues or estate issues, because that's really what you're going to have here. And what you're going to want to do is talk to them. When you get to the person who heads up that committee, because they're the people who arrange for all the speakers to come in to keep all the attorneys, you know, updated with all the latest information. They really know what's going on. You get to that person, you can explain the problem and say, I need some help. Do you have some recommendations for me, or do you help with this kind of thing? And usually the person who's the head of the committee is a really, really good attorney, and they're very well connected, and they know a lot of people. So they're going to give you good recommendations, and then you're going to go talk to some of those people. and you're going to say, I need to fix this. How do I do that? And you're going to hear from a couple of different people how they might recommend you do it. The first initial consultation should be free, and then after that you're going to pay by the hour. And then you're going to have to figure out what you have to do.
Okay. Now, okay.
I mean, this is not good. I know you wanted a different answer today.
No, well, you know, I wasn't sure, but I want to ask you this question. You might say, well, ask the attorney. But, like, I was thinking, can I just, you know, I want to just remove her now, but I know that probably they still might be able to see that I removed her and
yes.
still come after me.
Yes, 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 and yes. Yes, they will. You and that
really
may be okay. That may be okay if it goes, you know, she lives another 5 or 6 years, or it may not be okay. And so you need to talk to an attorney about what your options are. That will be one option, but it may not be the best option. There may be 3 or 4 other clever things that they might be able to do.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Can you make me a promise?
Yeah, I appreciate. Yeah, okay. What's the promise? I was just trying to be nice and thoughtful, and I ended up doing something that's just, you know, caused me all sorts of problems.
Next time you want to be nice,
yeah.
and you're signing your name to a legal document, I want you to ask somebody who's a lawyer what that means. Just because it's a lot less expensive and time consuming to find out before you do something like this that you've actually done it. Because it's not even a situation where when you did the quick claim, maybe it didn't get filed at the recorder's deed. Because you were sitting at the closing table, the closing people probably nicely said they would file it along with all the other paperwork. And so it's probably really filed, which means it's real. And now you have to deal with it in a way that's smart and sophisticated and strategic.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Susan. Good luck. Let me know how it goes. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. You know, folks, this is the one mistake in all these years of doing this radio show. This is the one mistake that I hear people express the most sorrow about. It is way too easy to be able to sign your name to a quick claim deed and transfer any ownership interest that you own in something to somebody else. It's way too easy to do that, and there's no time thinking about what that means on the other side. And so parents who transfer, you know, ownership interests in houses to their kids who do it to the parents, it's way too easy. You think you're solving a problem, but there's a whole Pandora's box that you may be opening, and Susan just opened it, and my heart's breaking for her right now. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Michael joins me on the line from Ackworth. Hi, Michael.
Hi, and happy New Year to you, and thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, and back at you. What's going on in your world?
My wife and I are looking at possibly looking for a vacation home in Florida. I do want to get something that would be seasonable rentable, to provide income also.
Mm-hmm.
And was wanting to get your take on that, the best way to approach it, whether it be foreclosure, stay away from foreclosure.
Oh, I don't, you know, I don't have a problem with foreclosures at all. I have a problem with people who buy foreclosures but aren't thoughtful about why they're in foreclosure and what's happened. So at a baseline, if you're going to buy a foreclosure, you'd probably want to look at the HUD Home website, which is hudhome.com. I think it's hudhomestore.com. But you can also talk to local real estate agents about short sales that are still available. Florida, depending on where you're looking in Florida, has some amazing deals still left. But when you go in and take a foreclosure or short sale, it's people who don't actually have the money to keep up the house. And so when they are they're not keeping up the house, all kinds of other things can crop up. They may not have paid assessments if they live in a community that has assessments, and you may be taking that on if you're not careful. The title may not be cleaned. There may be deferred maintenance in the property. There's all kinds of stuff that go into it. So if you can hang with me for a moment, Michael, we have to take a short break. But when we come back, I'll go over a few other things you want to be very careful of and when you're buying a foreclosure or a short sale, and also what you need to think about when you're hiring a real estate agent to help you do it. All right? 48 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Kling. Stay tuned. I'll be back in a moment with more on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, answering your money and real estate questions. Rebuilding America, one house at a time. Starting with yours, News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. This is the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It is 12:54. We were talking with Michael from Ackworth. He is thinking about buying a foreclosure in Florida. And so, Michael, we were talking about some of the places you might want to search for a foreclosure and some of the problems that you might find with deferred maintenance issues. People who can't afford to pay their mortgage typically don't also keep up with all the maintenance, and they don't always keep up with the costs that are required if they're in a community. So you may find that there is a large unpaid assessments bill, all of which has to be dealt with ahead of time. And if you're buying a vacation property, a second home, or an investment home, which is what this is supposed to be, you want to make sure that the community that you're buying in will allow you to rent it out, even if you're only renting it out part-time. So a lot of communities have clamped down on that. They don't want a lot of rentals, even in the vacation home ownership area. But if you're going to do it part-time and you're still going to maintain that as a residence, they may allow you to do it. But there are some specific rules that you're probably going to have to live by at the community. And if I were you, I would rather know those up front, right?
Correct, yes.
So all of those different pieces kind of come together that make vacation home ownership just a little bit more complicated, right?
Right.
Is this something that you'd think about moving to in retirement?
Yeah, I've got 2 years till I'm looking at retirement, and that's why the rental part of it is, you know, very important to me. And, of course, I recognize the fact that from favorite vacation places such as the Gulf Coast and or the Atlantic side,
mm-hmm.
from approximately 1st of May through the Labor Day holiday, I wanted to be out there for rental. To obtain that income during that period.
So you want to rent it out from May to Labor Day for the summer?
At minimum, and then go for longer term even after that point, leaving, you know, a block open of whether it be 8 or 12 weeks that we could use it ourselves, you know, during that time.
So I think what I would do is once you figure out what community you want to be in, I'm going to go back to the advice that I gave our other caller about vacation home ownership and send you to VRBO.com, vacationrentalbyowner.com, and some of the other vacation rental sites to look at where the homes that get rented for the most money in those areas are located,
mm-hmm.
how much people are getting, what kind of accommodations they are, what kind of shape the property needs to be in, how it needs to look. And vacation home ownership is a little bit different when you're going to do this kind of renting out in that it requires a lot of upkeep, right? You know, beds need to be, you need to have it fully decorated and fully out there, but, you know, beds get ruined faster, bedspreads, carpets, people chip dishes, things walk away. So there's some extra maintenance that I'd love for you to think about. Just to make sure that you're not, you know, going to run into a, you know, financial headache down the line. And you'll find that you're going to, every year, you're probably going to need to do some updating and upkeep. And you may even, if you buy a foreclosure, especially because it's, you know, they probably didn't have the money to maintain it, you may have to go in and do a serious amount of rehab right at the beginning. Beyond paint and carpet, you may have to do, you know, bathroom changes or a kitchen update or something. All of which hopefully will come back to you. Because you're going to be able to rent it for more money. So those are the kinds of issues that you want to think about as you're looking at different places. I wouldn't buy anything sight unseen, and I would try to find a real estate agent who spends a whole lot of time working in the foreclosure and short sale market, because they're the ones who really understand what banks are looking for a short sale and a foreclosure, what kind of offer they'll take, what kind of documentation you're going to need to have on hand to make it an easier process for you.
Sounds wonderful. A lot of that I have already thought of, and so I appreciate everything you've said, and especially the website that you referred to.
Good. Yeah, I think it's a terrific tool, and it's one that I use when I'm going to look for property. And then I'm going to give you, again, that last piece of advice. You probably want to use put up a website that says something like Fabulous Vacation Home for Rent in Florida or whatever it is, so that people who are looking in that area will be able to find you. And we will spend a whole lot more time this year on how people can find you online. So investors who bought property, now you want to be able to rent it out, and we'll talk about how. All right, the music's starting. That means our first show of 2015 is over. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Be sure to find me online, and I'll be back next Sunday for another edition of the show. Have a great week, everybody.